This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg of the Remnant Podcast, which is brought to you by thedispatch.com and Dispatch Media. You can go to thedispatch.com and sign up now. We've actually opened up the normal yearly subscription sign-ups. If you want to do that, that would be great for us. It helps us have a more predictable revenue stream for the first year, and it's a great vote of confidence, and it's a wonderful thing to do during this holiday season, and it would make me happy. But you don't have to do it. Everything's going to be free for a while, but I just wanted to get that out there. So we're actually recording. Oh, and today's episode is brought to you by DoorDash. More about them later. So we're recording this episode on Thursday of what humans of the future will call last week. And we just had the constitutional experts testify about impeachment stuff. And we wanted to get one of the – I've called him for years a Vulcan because it's not entirely clear to me that he's a human being because he's so smart. And one of my oldest friends in Washington, Ramesh Panuru, former colleague at National Review, still a colleague at the American Enterprise Institute, Bloomberg columnist, senior editor of National Review, and who married up to April Panuru, who we all love. Ramesh, thanks for coming on.
Glad to be here.
So I wanted to get that out there that we could be a little dated because over the weekend, you know, on the Sunday shows, Mick Mulvaney or Rudy Giuliani could sort of flip and spill the beans or whatever, but
Or spill the beans without even intending to.
That's right. Or sometimes, you know, refuse to spill the beans at the beginning of a sentence and then spill them at the end of the sentence. I want to just sort of get your – but since for the most part, nothing ever changes. Polling never changes. People are all locked in. Attitudes on impeachment, except for a few independents who've slid back against it, haven't changed. Want to get you sort of your – first, your sort of the rank punditry take on where you think – the impeachment stuff is, where do you think it's going? And then we can get into the more qualitative stuff about what should happen and why it's not going to.
Well, the debate over impeachment, all of the politics of it are structured by the key constitutional provision, which is the two-thirds bar for removing a president in the Senate. And so when you assess the arguments and counterarguments from a political point of view, all the Republicans have to do is hold roughly a third of the country. And so the arguments may not be particularly good. In many cases, they aren't, although they vary. But they don't have to be that good,
right,
in order to fulfill that function. And I think one of the interesting things about the politics of impeachment, though, is that to the extent it reinforces the Republicans' impulse to just hug that base, it gets in the way of a strategy for winning the 2020 election,
mm-hmm.
Which may not be entirely unintended on the part of the Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, so sometimes you hear these galaxy brain theories about what the Democrats are really up to, and that it's an attempt to sort of to Benghazi Trump, to sort of soften him up, but not actually seek impeachment, that it's that the impeachment push is just a way to sort of de facto censure him and weaken him. But if you actually talk to actual Democrats, they actually really want to impeach him, right? I mean, that's the sort of like in we both remember 1998 with Bill Clinton, 1999. There was a lot of game theory about what Republicans were really trying to do. And then you actually talk to actual Republicans and they really want to impeach him. Where do you come down on the strategery here?
Well, I think the Democrats would like to remove him if they could. I think they are all pretty much well aware that that is not going to happen. But they want to go on record. They do want to weaken him for the 2020 election. My argument has always been on this narrow political point that if you want to run against Trump in important part on the ground that he is a corrupt abuser of power and you control the House of Representatives, you sort of have to impeach him.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's not as though the Democrats were ever going to run a campaign that was like the Clinton campaign against George H.W. Bush in 1992, where you just say, well, maybe he's well-meaning, but he's a failure and he's out of touch. It was going to be a much more harder-edged campaign. I think you can't be in a position where Trump could say, well, you know, Joe Biden, if anybody really believed the things you're saying about me, your friends in the House would have impeached me, and they didn't, because everybody knows this is just political rhetoric. So I do think they have to follow through on this. But they are clearly still half-hearted about it. Nancy Pelosi's caution, her resistance to doing this still, I think, shows through in the kind of timeline that they've adopted. And I think some Republicans, including the Republican witness on the constitutional hearing, Jonathan Turley, were right in saying, you know, if this is really serious, then why aren't you taking more time to get more witnesses and really do more investigation and deliberation?
Yeah, I have to say, I thought Turley's argument was, you can quibble with it and serious people can disagree with it, but I thought it was pretty persuasive that if this really is a serious impeachment, the idea that you're not going to exhaust all of your opportunities and resources and avenues in terms of getting the right witnesses in and all of that kind of stuff is a mistake. It's just a mistake for gaining public support and all of the rest. But I guess the part of the problem I have with it is that at the end of the day, it's just a really fancy, very good process argument, right? It's not a evidentiary argument. It's not a he didn't do it argument. This process is mean, and therefore we shouldn't impeach him.
Well, it's also a process argument that cannot be made with a straight face by the administration, because the administration's view is not that we need a more extensive investigation.
Right.
It's that this is a distraction from the important business of doing whatever it is that the Congress is supposed to be doing besides investigating the president.
Yeah. So, I mean, I really want to get our colleague or friend Andy McCarthy in here when next time he's in Washington, because you're the wrong person to grill about this. But this argument that the process has been unfair and that the Republicans weren't allowed to call witnesses, are you aware of any witnesses that they wanted to call in these closed hearings that were actually exculpatory witnesses? Or wasn't the whole point that they want to bring in Hunter Biden and Joe Biden and that kind of stuff? That's not contradicting the facts as alleged against Trump. That's just trying to fuel the same narrative that he's trying to get Ukraine to fuel. Or am I missing something?
No, I think that's right. I keep being reminded of something a Republican strategist told me during the Clinton impeachment when we were both much younger. That
speak for yourself.
That the he said, you know, the Democratic strategy against impeachment was to put on red noses and big floppy shoes and then complain it was a circus.
Right.
And that's really what the House Republicans have been doing.
So do you think that there's anything foreseeable that changes the trajectory of this? Do you think, you know, you're hearing more and more talk about how maybe they just don't even impeach and go to censure. Do you think that's possible? Do you think that's a smarter play?
I think it would be an enormous political problem for the Democrats to go to censure instead of impeachment. I think
because
I think that it's just such a climb down on their part. If you look at the 2018 exit polls, three quarters of people who voted for the Democrats were for impeachment already. This was before anybody was talking about Ukraine. And so to go through all of this and then pull up short, I think would be a mistake politically, especially since impeachment without conviction in the Senate functions pretty much as a censure, as as the president has reportedly said. It's a black mark on the resume. And I'm not really sure what you gain. You do. I do hear people say, you know, I hear a lot of Republicans say, well, gosh, why are they putting the country through this? Like, putting the country through what? Yeah. I mean, was 1999 such a terrible year in American history because there was an impeachment and then a quick Senate trial that didn't lead to conviction?
But isn't – couldn't you make the case that if Nancy Pelosi could pull it off, and I agree that's a big if, that a censure vote is a much harder vote for Republican senators, right, than an impeachment vote? A censure vote is much harder vote for Republican House members too, right? I mean, because a lot of these people would like to say, I don't like what President Trump did, but it's not impeachable. And the impeachment vote allows them to vote with the president. The censure vote creates a problem where they might have to vote against the president. Or do I have that wrong?
I imagine that Republicans would find a way to wiggle out of any such challenge. So, you know, well, of course, I don't approve of everything that the president has said or done, but a censure is a really extraordinary move. You know, you can hear what they would say.
So on the substance stuff,
there's no constitutional provision for a censure, right? Which is actually true.
Which is true. Yeah. You know? So one of the arguments you hear, which I actually think is kind of a good one, is that the what the founders meant by bribery was very, you know, so what you do is you get this, you hear Democrats say, look, what President Trump did fits the exact definition of bribery in the federal statutes. And I think they make a good case there. The problem is that there were no federal statutes against bribery when the Constitution was written. There are only like three crimes in the Constitution, right? And originally all criminal law was supposed to be at the state level. So what they meant by bribery was much more grandiose than what the now federal code says. Do you think that the bribery of the federal code is commensurate to the bribery clause in the Constitution?
I don't. But I also think that bribery is an odd way of looking at this because – I mean, typically when we think about bribery, you know, you're bribing a cop to not enforce the law or something like that. You know, bribing the president of Ukraine is a different kind of thing. I mean, we don't in a certain sense, we don't care about the integrity of Ukrainian law. Mm-hmm. It's perfectly acceptable for us, for the U.S. government to bribe in the sense of offering inducements, positive and negative, to get a foreign government to do something that's actually in the national interest. The problem here isn't really the bribery. The problem is what the Ukrainian government is being asked to do in exchange for the bribe. So I think it fits more comfortably into the category of kind of an abuse of power that is a high crime and misdemeanor. But in general, I just think it is a huge mistake to try to think of impeachable offenses in terms of statutory crimes. Mm-hmm. That is the legalization of the impeachment process, which just pervades the debate over it in all kinds of unhelpful ways.
So where, I mean, just a big picture, and for listeners who are sick of all of this, we're going to move off of this shortly. But just big picture, where do you come down on the questions? Was it an impeachable crime? Do you think he did it? And if you think he did it and it's impeachable, do you think he should be impeached? Because those are three separate questions. And then fourth, should he be removed?
Okay, so I think that the evidence is quite strong that he conditioned official acts of the U.S. government on the Ukrainian government taking steps to help him, or that he perceived would help him. And that is an abuse of power. Whether it's an impeachable offense, you know, the thing that gets fuzzy here is there is an element of political judgment that is required in reaching that conclusion. So there is a subjectivity to it. That's why people want to jump to, well, is it a statutory
right.
offense? Because you can make it more objective. But I think in the nature of things, it just can't be that objective. I think it is in the right ballpark. So a Congress that found this kind of thing worthy of impeachment would be within its rights. The question would be sort of, is it serious enough? Is it grave enough? And then given the totality of political circumstances, is this the right thing to do? I think the most powerful argument against impeachment is the fact that you've got this impending election coming up. And so if people find this unacceptable behavior in a president, they can take action that way. But I think that I would be very likely, if I were in the House, to vote to impeach. And in the Senate, I would be deliberating long and hard, but I would be seriously considering removal.
Yeah. So
but I haven't won my primary yet, so.
There. And besides, we're grooming you for Supreme Court. But the Fed, yeah.
Yeah, I need to look into this question of whether one can simultaneously serve on the Fed.
Dual appointment on the Fed and the Supreme Court? That'd be awesome. Everyone would return your phone calls. I hear you. The only problem I have, not the only problem, but is that if it would be more cut and dried if he were pressuring the Ukrainians to build a Trump hotel in Kiev, right? Or Kyiv, as we're supposed to say. I think more people would recognize that as a sort of an abuse of power if he was like you saying, you don't get military aid unless you build my hotel. At the same time, I'd be more inclined to argue that that's a better case to leave to the voters. But what he was trying to do was actually influence his political chance, you know, the election. I mean, people use meddling with the election a little too glibly, but what he was trying to do was increase his chances of getting reelected by doing something slimy with Biden. I actually think that the CrowdStrike stuff is more disturbing than the Biden stuff. But the problem with saying leave it to the voters just on the merits is that the whole crime alleged is that he was trying to play games with the voters, right? He was trying to muck up the election and put his thumb on the scale of election. So when you say leave it to the voters, if you can't punish that, then that sort of gets at the heart of why we have an impeachment, you know, provision in the first place. My understanding is, you know, it's not clear to me that Madison would have wanted an impeachment clause if he knew we were going to have presidential term limits, right? The whole idea was to keep a president from abusing his power to stay in office and all that kind of stuff and turning into a tyrant. If you have an election, that's a safeguard against that. But if he's committing acts to skew the election in his favor, then that argues more for impeachment rather than less to me than some other crime.
So the reason I reject that argument is I think it doesn't take into account the political context of impeachment versus an election. To beat President Trump in an election requires much less of a public consensus against him than his impeachment and removal. To impeach and remove him, you would need something in the ballpark of two-thirds of the public being against him. If you have that degree of public consensus, he is not anywhere – he doesn't have the power to manipulate his way into re-election. And so the bar is just so much lower to defeat him in an election that it's – there's sort of not an either-or choice here.
Okay.
What I do think is a better argument for impeachment over an election is that impeachment and removal you would get rid of the potential abuser of power, but you don't have a total change in the ideological orientation of the president, right? You replace him with another Republican president. Whereas an election, you're forced to make this choice between somebody who's an abuser of power but maybe is better on a wide range of issues than the potential replacement.
So I will force a transition into this. People talk all the time about how this is a coup, right? Most coups don't replace the ruler with the ruler's hand-picked successor in terms of President Pence, right? This wouldn't overturn the election in the case of in the sense of making Hillary Clinton president or anything like that. But it does sort of on the politics side, moving past impeachment, the idea that Mike Pence could replace Donald Trump politically on the right, you know, like the idea of, the prospect of watching Mike Pence try to fill a stadium with people wearing MAGA hats and cheering the way they do for Donald Trump strikes me as highly implausible, right? And so that sort of, in my rough, aphasic kind of way, gets us to what the future of the Republican Party is, right? Mike Pence clearly thinks he's the future of the Republican Party, or at least that's what he wakes up every morning trying to convince himself. Does the GOP, whether – let's assume he's not impeached. Let's assume he makes it that he – whether he's reelected or not, do you – how Trumpy do you think the future of the GOP is?
Well, I think it depends a lot on whether he loses in 2020 and if he loses, how he loses. So does he lose by a large margin? Does he lose while also having Republicans lose the Kansas Senate seat and, and lose control of the Senate and so forth? I think in general, parties are very vicious in turning on their losers. So you think about the reputation, the political reputation of Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush. Now, those people can be rehabilitated as people. Americans are pretty forgiving in that respect. But parties tend to view those people as having been serious mistakes in retrospect. Now, of course, Trump's been has defied the odds in a lot of ways. But I think that there are an awful lot of Republicans who have been supporting him on basically just partisan grounds. And once that is no longer something that binds them to him, that he'd look a lot different in the rearview mirror. I don't think that the party goes back to its pre-Trump orientation. I think there will be some people in the party who want to carry on as though nothing has changed, but I don't think that that is going to be possible because the party's base has been changing. Trump was responding to a change in the composition of the party, and then he accelerated that change. And so it's a more working class party than it used to be. And I think it's going to have to reflect that. And, you know, we can't – Republican politicians can't sort of unknow things that everybody now knows about what Republican voters are actually like and want, so that they're not quite as rigidly free market in orientation as pre-2016 Republicans might have thought. So to get this in more concrete terms, I don't think that the Republican Party is necessarily going to go protectionist, but I think it's going to have a larger protectionist wing than it had before Trump.
Can you have – I mean just on the demographics – is it? Is there any scenario conceivably where you can have the Republicans become a working class party without doing much better with minorities, with Hispanics and blacks? Are there enough working class whites, if you lose the suburbs, to be a majority white party without, while also going at this sort of non-college educated working class voter is the heart of your coalition?
Well, timing is everything. And
Nixon could do it.
You know, it's right after the 2012 election, there were all these people who were saying things, all these Republican strategists, you know, many of them pro the Republican National Committee's autopsy, were saying things like, you know, Republicans have to get 40% of the non-white vote. No, this is not true, as it turned out. But over the long run, given the change in the racial demography of the country, no, there aren't enough white working class voters. It is true, right? I mean, the whole idea that the Democrats had that there's this coalition of the ascendant, and that they were doing strong among groups that are rising as a share of the American electorate, that's true. It's just, you know, they were sort of counting on that happening faster than it did.
Mm-hmm.
I think of the Clinton 2016 strategy a little bit like the old adage that there's no reward for being prematurely right in the stock market.
Right.
And so I think you could have a 2020 result where you do a little bit better even among white working class voters than last time. And that's enough,
mm-hmm.
Particularly given the distribution of those voters. But does that carry you through to having, you know, winning a majority of the 2024, 2028, 2032 elections? Probably not.
Yeah. So where do you come – so this is something we've talked about a lot off microphone. The general argument you get, the sort of mirror image argument, it's weird. You know, I've had these confrontations with these alt-right kids a couple times in the last month, and – there's a remarkable amount of analytical consensus between the sort of, let's call it the Michelle Malkin crowd and the politics of the ascendant crowd, and that they both believe that we're importing Democratic voters, that there is something congenital to being a minority that makes you vote Democrat for all time, and that if they keep voting Democrat, that means it's the... it's the end. Well, it's actually they both sides believe it's the end of America. Just one laments it and the other one doesn't. Where do you come down on all of that? I've always been a bit squishier at National. Well, I was always a bit squishier at National Review on the immigration stuff than you. And then our editorial line was. But I never thought that there was anything inherently racist or evil about trying to impose a rational immigration policy and enforcing it. And we were called that often. It was called nativist and racist for wanting to do that, including by many people who are now very ardent Trump supporters. How do you score the level of concern one should have about that as a conservative, about the demographic arguments about whether it's the Democratic version of them, the sort of Rudy Teixeira version of them, or the sort of Steve King version of them?
So, look, I mean, it's just the case that immigrants skew more Democratic in their voting than native-born Americans. And political parties pay attention to that kind of thing. The Democrats certainly do. I don't think there's anything in principle wrong with the Republicans doing that. I do think it would be a mistake for Republicans to write off immigrants completely, because there's a difference between, you know, getting 35% of a group's vote and getting 15 or 20%
right.
of a group's vote. I mean, that's sort of part of, to get back to what I was saying about Hillary Clinton, part of what the problem was the way they basically wrote off the white working class vote. If she'd held her losses to Obama levels in the upper Midwest, she'd be president.
Right.
I certainly don't think in any kind of – I don't believe in any kind of like biological predilection to vote for Democrats or Republicans, which is obviously, you know, counter-indicated by the fact that groups change their political alignments over time. I do think that assimilation is likely to weaken a group's sense that it needs to be with the Democratic Party, and that a different immigration policy would better promote assimilation. So the main reason I want a more assimilative immigration policy is because I think social cohesion, a shared sense of belonging on the part of the country is a good thing, but I do think it would probably have some long-term benefits for Republicans as well.
Yeah. But this...
But you've got to find a way to promote that sort of thing without communicating the idea that you hate immigrants.
Right.
People are oddly averse to voting for people they think hate them.
But there's also this notion out there that that the racial categories that we have today, or the ethnic categories, whatever you want to put it, are locked in and eternal, right? I mean, you go back and you look at how many Italians were not only did not consider themselves white, but were not considered white. White as a category was several ticks below where it is, where people think it is today. I mean, the very few WASPs in the sort of Brahmin establishment, right, particularly cared that you were white if you were Irish or if you were Italian or something like that. And you have lots of Hispanics who call themselves white. You have lots of Asians who may not call themselves white, but culturally assimilate fairly white. Do you think that the political valence of whiteness is as baked into the cake on from either side of the analysis?
No, I mean I do think that is.
I mean, you're one of the whitest people I know.
thank you.
I don't know.
okay, but
I handle spicier food better than you do.
Yeah, this is. I was at an Indian restaurant the other day, and they obviously made assumptions about me and made the food spicier than I wanted, and it was. I think it's just like textbook microaggression on the part of fellow Indian Americans. But anyway, leaving that aside, all of these projections about when the U.S. becomes majority minority,
right,
in the 2040s or 2050, the precise estimate shifts over time. They presuppose that mixed race people won't consider themselves white.
Right.
That Hispanics won't consider themselves white. And, you know, maybe that will be true. It may be that in modern America, identifying as white, it has less social cachet despite your best efforts than it used to have. But we don't know that. I think that is very much an open question.
Yeah. I mean, I just, as someone who grew up in New York City, the idea of finding a great source of meaning and identity and whiteness always struck me as kind of weird. You know, well, as a white person, I think. You know, I just never began a sentence that way. But since you brought up I brought up Indian food. Were you particularly offended by Tom Nichols's attack on Indian food? Did you see this on Twitter? It caused a great deal of outrage.
I did see this. From time to time, he puts out a tweet that makes me question his judgment.
But that wasn't one of them?
and his judgment about Indian food is just obviously and objectively mistaken.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some people who say that there's no disputing taste, but this is wrong.
Yeah.
His taste is wrong.
Yeah.
There's
also an enormous diversity of Indian food. I mean, there are more languages in India than there are in Europe, right? And there are more cuisines probably too.
Yeah, but I think it's okay to have to assume that he was meaning sort of the kind of Indian food you get in America.
Yeah, sure.
That's right.
And that's good stuff. I love
yeah.
it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, you know, and there is more of a sameness to those restaurants than there is to the actual cuisine of India. He's got his weird taste. That's fine. I would not have.
I mean, we can all agree that Ethiopian food is awful, right? Anyway, I don't want to get you in trouble there.
There goes all of the Ethiopian sponsors of this great podcast. Hope you realize what you've done.
Just so you know, I don't know if I told you this. You know, my daughter last summer did this special tour thing in India and Nepal. And she came back and I was like, so Lucy, what is your, what's like your one big takeaway after seeing all this? And she told us all these stories about poverty and traffic and hiking in the Himalayas, all these great things. And I said, so what's the one big takeaway? And she said, it's going to be a long time before I go back to India voluntarily. but I, just to be clear, I really love Indian food. And one of the reasons why I love DoorDash is I can get Indian food from a lot of different places. So that's a good reason to talk to you about DoorDash. Crushing it at work? Laser focused on beating that boss level? That doesn't mean you shouldn't eat. DoorDash can help you get your next meal from your favorite restaurant in minutes, because DoorDash connects you to all of your favorite restaurants in your city. Ordering is easy. Open the DoorDash app, choose what you want to eat, and your food will be delivered to you wherever you are. Not only is your favorite pizza joint already on DoorDash, but there are over 340,000 restaurants in 3,300 cities. So you might find a new favorite, too. With door-to-door delivery in all 50 states and Canada, order from your local go-tos or choose from your favorite national restaurants like Chipotle, Wendy's, Chick-fil-A, and the Cheesecake Factory. Don't worry about dinner. Let dinner come to you with DoorDash. So right now, our listeners can get $5 off their first order of $15 or more when you download the DoorDash app and enter promo code REMNANT. That's $5 off your first order when you download the DoorDash app from the App Store and enter promo code REMNANT. Not Dingo, but REMNANT, REMNANT. Don't forget, that's promo code REMNANT for $5 off your first order from DoorDash. Okay, so since I mentioned DoorDash, one of the things that companies like DoorDash and Uber and all these kind of places do is they are disruptive to sort of the incumbents in a given market. And this is something that a lot of conservatives all of a sudden have decided is very bad. The creative destruction is bad, that the Schumpeterian gale of capitalism needs to be fortified against. And we've seen a bunch of different versions of this attempt now. What do we call it? The Amariites, the Amerians. There's Rubio with Rubionomics, and there's Josh Hawley with his stuff. And there's our old friend Tucker Carlson, who's saying, I would argue, a lot of economically ridiculous things these days. First of all, what's your general take on it? Do you think that there are some versions of it that are better than others? And if so, why? And is this sort of economic planning of the right the future of the GOP?
So I'm less hostile to, say, Senator Rubio's speech on what he calls common good capitalism than a lot of my free market friends. I've got an article coming out in the next National Review on this. I sent to you for comment.
I know, but I'm sorry. I apologize.
So it is now – it's devoid of your insight and wisdom, yeah. I'm afraid. So I think that some of the questions are the right questions. So government does exist to pursue the common good, right, to pursue goods that we cannot achieve on our own or even in coordination with other people in groups that are smaller than the state. Now, how we do that is a different question. And I think that and I'm just going to stick with Senator Rubio because having read him the last couple of days, I'm more familiar with where he's coming from. So he doesn't – there's a lot of things he doesn't explicitly say in the speech, but that if you put a lot of attention on what he's focusing on the speech, you'll make some assumptions. So for example, is it true that markets can sometimes and should sometimes be limited shaped to pursue the common good? I think that's absolutely correct. Is it true that a central problem or the central problem of our society is that we haven't shaped the market enough and that we've allowed the market to run wild? I think that is a much, much more dubious proposition. Now, he never says that, right? He never says that that's the fundamental problem. And maybe that's because he's just trying to get conservatives to reexamine something they take for granted as opposed to just echoing the stuff that he agrees with all conservatives on. But I think it was a mistake. It was a rhetorical mistake because there's plenty of places where what we have is precisely a failure to allow markets to thrive and to fulfill their potential. I mean, I think some of the great problems we have with our economy have to do with the overregulation of housing markets.
It's not unfettered capitalism. It's right. Fettered capitalism.
It's deeply fettered capitalism, yeah. Right? Or with the a higher education system in this country that is largely shaped by government policies and particularly by federal policies. Now, at some level, Rubio knows this because he's introduced a lot of good legislation
right. On
a lot of these subjects. But you would not get a sense from listening to a speech that that we live in something other than a night watchman state.
Mm-hmm. But what does it say about the GOP these days that – I'm no Luke Thompson. I'm no comfortably smug. I am not a Rubio basher. I actually like Rubio. But one can say without fear of instant contradiction that Rubio has very sensitive political antenna and that he likes to get out in front of ideas in ways that lots of politicians do, but he hides it worse than some do. What does it say that Rubio is sort of following in the footsteps of Hawley in this, this new fetishization of the state, knowing how to jigger the knobs of the economy in ways that promote the common good?
So I take a little bit of a broader historical view of this and just say every major attempt at redefining conservatism or the Republican Party for a very long time has involved softening the edges of its support for free market capitalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think arguably you could even look at Ronald Reagan as an example of this, who runs in 1980 very pointedly not being the second coming of Goldwater, but being somebody who has sort of Goldwaterite instincts but also says, I'm not going to threaten your Medicare and Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
George H.W. Bush, I'm going to be kinder and gentler.
More will than wallet.
George W. Uh-huh. Bush, compassionate conservatism. So I think that there has long been a sense among Republican politicians that the weak point of the Republican Party platform was its economic agenda. And I think mm-hmm. that's right. Now, the question is sort of, given that, I think, true point. So what do you do about it? How do you adjust the Republican message? And I think that Rubio is right in thinking that the party needs to be a little less abstract, a little less dogmatic, and particularly given the change in the composition of the party, a little more oriented toward helping working class voters. Now, that doesn't – I think it shouldn't mean that we just become big government liberals or just sort of embrace state planning and forget everything we've always known about the limits of what government can do and the ways government intervention can go wrong. And some of it should mean that we just have different kinds of a free market agenda. As I was saying, I think there's a lot of things that we could be doing. To throw in another one, getting back at the proliferation of occupational licensing,
mm-hmm.
Which I think has become a real problem, a real obstacle to opportunity. So maybe you change the agenda, but I think that to put maybe the best construction on it, the election of Trump was an enormously disorienting event for a lot of conservatives, and I think a lot of people are trying to sort of think through or feel through. What a post-Trump conservatism should look like. I thought sort of the funniest line in Rubio's speech is when he sort of piously disavows any thought of trying to define a post-Trump conservatism. That's not unsubstantial. Obviously, obviously that is among his goals.
Okay, so I'm going to put you back on your reformicon heels a little bit here. I'm totally with you. Let's major free market reform of occupational licensing. I'm more and more interested in how zoning is screwing things up at the local level, and it's really important that one of the unanticipated consequences of fixing, to a large extent, the crime problem has basically priced out cheap labor from cities, which is a huge problem for poor people and a huge problem for cities, for cost of living. So I'm with you on all the free market ways of jiggering with some of that stuff. What are the non-free market things that you're in favor of? Like you would say are, you know, that run against deregulatory, the sort of deregulatory, because you say that these politicians are right about the political prospect, about the economic message of conservatism. Is that economic message in fact wrong, or is it just a bad political issue? Like, where do you come down where you side more on the Holly, Rubio, I won't say Rusty Reno, but, you know, on the sort of the triangulating against, on the merits, against unfettered capitalism?
Well, I'm a pretty pro-capitalist guy, but I think that there's been a way of thinking about what a free market reformist agenda would be, uh-huh. right? And so I would say both politically and substantively, an agenda that is just about cutting the top tax rate and entitlement reform and free trade, all of which I think are good ideas. Mm-hmm. That's not enough. That's not a sufficient basis for successful conservative politics. And it's not enough for promoting the common good. Now, as you know, I have been a strong proponent of pro-family tax reform, the idea that parents, in particular parents of large families, should get tax relief. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that is entirely compatible with a free market and even a libertarian way of thinking about government. But it doesn't seem to be a natural way mm-hmm. so of thinking for a lot of people who think of themselves as free marketeers and libertarians. So, you know, in December of 2017, there was a vote. Should we cut the corporate tax rate a little bit less in order to expand the child credit a little bit more? And Rubio said, you know, Rubio sponsored that idea. And Holly was not in the Senate yet, but he was in favor of that idea. And I was very strongly in favor of that idea. The Wall Street Journal editorial board acted as though, you know, this was some sort of dark ages plot to destroy capitalism. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I don't know whether – so I wouldn't say that I think that we should move away from free market capitalism. I do think that there is a kind of rigid and dogmatic way of thinking about it that we have to move away from.
That is a very politic answer, and I agree with it entirely.
Well, I think it's true.
Yeah, no, it has the benefit of being true. Okay, so we don't have to get deep on the weeds in this, but I do find it fascinating. You are for a common good capitalism, rightly defined, whatever, promoting the common good, and blah, 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 and that the market, the politics of unfettered capitalism are bad, so we need to find productive ways to use market principles towards productive ends, yada, yada, yada. And yet, you are for drug legalization. How do you square these things?
So I think that in particular the federal war on drugs uh-huh. and a maximal federal posture on marijuana is just hard to defend. And I don't think of it on sort of libertarian fight for your right to party grounds. Uh-huh. I think of it just in terms of the consequences and the costs of this. And, you know, if you think about the origins of the war on drugs and the rhetoric around it, the idea that, you know, we need a drug-free America, well, that's a utopian goal, right? Mm-hmm. That's not the basis on which we support all kinds of laws, like laws against homicide. It's not we need a homicide-free America, right? I mean, that's, you know, that's just that all by itself should tell you that something is going wrong mm-hmm. with the way we are thinking about this question. No, but I'm not for legalizing heroin, for mm-hmm. example. And on the marijuana case, my views on this have changed over the years. I do think if you think about the strongest points in the legalizer case in terms of, you know, running the risk of harassing or even imprisoning people and changing the priorities of law enforcement in bad ways and creating black markets and so on and so forth, and all the crime that's attendant on that, I think that all of that is a reason for legalizing the possession and sale and consumption of marijuana. It's not, I think, a great reason for legalizing the for-profit sale of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you probably – and Mark, the late Mark Kleinman, I think, was pretty persuasive on the idea that you could have a legalization that was not a kind of a commercial kind of Wild West where we're going to try to get as many people hooked on the highest potency stuff that we possibly can.
So
it's a, so my view on it is a practical kind of, you know, like what actually does promote the common good here.
And – but my recollection is that the editorial position of National Review was against the drug war toot sweet, right? I mean, it was the whole thing.
The war on drugs has failed was Bill Buckley's cover editorial back in 96.
Right. And that included heroin, right? That included cocaine. That included all sorts of fun things.
But Bill was not especially – I mean, Bill said the federal war on drugs should end.
Uh-huh.
He didn't really say what should replace it. And over the years, under Buckley's influence, so to speak, the magazine experimented with all kinds of things. I just keep relapsing into the drug talk. Where, you know, I think we ran a story on sort of let's have a federal drug store, which actually makes a lot of sense because if you want something to be overpriced and undersupplied deliberately,
right,
make it a federal monopoly. Yeah, I mean, I think the idea was I don't know whether he would have said all drugs everywhere, you know, should be legal at every level of government.
He was no Charlie Cook, right?
Right.
Because Charlie actually does.
I'm sure Charlie would take that.
Yeah, which I think is.
And why should there be, you know, why shouldn't all medicine be over the counter?
Right. Yeah. I'm content with the fact that I lost my preferences on the weed thing. I was always for decriminalization. I would have really liked it if Colorado was the only state to do that for like 10 years and we could do lots of data gathering and look at it and see how it went. This mad rush everywhere across the country to legalize it everywhere, I think it was a mistake, but it's not the end of the world. But legalizing heroin seems like a very bad idea to me. And I remember asking early on in my tenure at National Review, I remember asking you and Rich and a bunch of people what the editorial position of the magazine would be on the war on drugs if the war on drugs worked. And I could never get a completely clear answer on that one. But anyway, I just think it's funny that there's
We know Charlie's view. What Charlie's view would be on this.
Yes, no, we do. But there's just this thing about the common good capitalism stuff seems to me at odds with the idea of legalizing drugs. Right. I mean, if you think that there's a place for the state to sort of intervene for the common good, then
yeah, it's incompatible with the sort of the pure libertarian case for
right.
legalizing drugs. But it's not incompatible with the conservative case for legalizing drugs. That has to do with, you know, sort of the limits of what government can achieve as opposed to the unbounded rights of the individual to do anything he wants.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know you exempted Rubio from actually saying unfettered capitalism is the problem. But it does seem like our friend and now colleague, J.D. Vance and some other people and, you know, and Tucker makes this case. There is this claim out there, which I think is just a flat out straw man, that Washington has been run by libertarians for the last 30 years, that all we do is deregulate the economy and that's where all our problems come from. Tucker.
They're using libertarian in the loose sense to include Bill Clinton.
Right. but I mean, it's just... there are lots of ways you can use Bill Clinton in the loose sense, but for an entire sort of claim of repudiation of the what you know, the dead consensus or the old conservative project, for it to depend so glaringly and heavily on a straw man of this idea that all we've been doing is pursuing free market policies, free market in the culture, free market in the economy for the last 30 years. I think is a real tell about how weak their actual case is. That combined with the really glaring lack of specifics that you often get from all of these guys. But I guess I'm coming back to the question I had at the beginning is, what does it say about conservatism? Forget the politicians, right? Because they'll go where, as you point out, they go where they think the votes are. A bunch of guys from Claremont and some other places just came out with a new open letter or manifesto. They seem to be coming out every week. And Rusty Reno seems to be signing all of them, calling for a new tech, a tech New Deal. And I think it's really kind of interesting that, you know, it was James Polos and the American Mind people and the presidents of Claremont Institute signed it. The Claremont Review of Books has been playing, has been using the New Deal as a pinata for its entire existence, right? Just the whole concept of it, the actual manifestation of it, as a historical epoch, its role as a continuation of Wilsonianism. And I know this in part because I wrote a lot of those pieces for the Claremont Review of Books, and I reviewed the giant phone book size compendium of the 10 or 15 year anniversary of the Claremont Review of Books. And now they're using New Deal as a stand-in for a good thing, which I just think is interesting. Regardless of where they come down on the actual tech stuff, there does seem to be, from Hazzoni and all these others, a move on the right towards this idea of that left-wing statism is bad, but right-wing statism might have something going for it. Should I be more concerned about this or less concerned about this? You seem remarkably unconcerned about it to me.
Well, no, I wouldn't say I'm unconcerned. Maybe I'm not as concerned as you are. I think that some of these ideas are sort of inchoate, if that's the right way to pronounce that. I've never known.
Yeah.
And need to be sort of developed and channeled a little bit. I do think, for example, the people who are drawing on Catholic social teaching should be more mindful of the fact that Catholic social teaching includes subsidiarity,
mm-hmm.
As a strong principle, really, that it is wrong to entrust something that can be entrusted to a lower level of social organization to a higher one, and that property rights are real. Doesn't mean they can't ever be limited, but they also have to be respected. And you don't hear those notes sounded. You don't have as much acknowledgement as I think you should that markets are a kind of cultural achievement that serves the common good.
Mm-hmm.
I've shied away from critique of sort of this kind of general complex of ideas because it is so general, and try to stick to specific things that people have said, and in a lot of cases they don't say enough for you to issue that critique.
All right. So some just last rank punditry now. Who's going to be the Democratic nominee and why?
Having failed to predict the 2016 election on the day of the 2016 election, I am I'm a little leery of making such forecasts. I have, however, throughout this process, been more bullish about Joe Biden's chances than a lot of other people. I think his flaws are obvious as a candidate, but I think that they have been exaggerated by the woke left,
mm-hmm.
And by in particular by the social media left, that the sort of young woke identity politics focused left is just wildly overrepresented, especially on Twitter, in a way that distorts the way Democratic political strategists and mainstream journalists think about these things. I think it's one of the things that led to the Kamala Harris campaign's failure was mm-hmm. that they misidentified where the voters were. It turns out that the Democrat social media problems are bigger than Russians on Facebook. And so I'd take the field over Biden, but I'd take Biden over any other person in the field.
And if it's a Biden-Trump matchup?
Well, tell me how the economy is doing in the spring and early summer of mm-hmm. 2020. But I would think that Biden wins.
Yeah. And if it's a warm...
And by the way, I do think, regardless of who the Democratic nominee is, whichever party wins the presidency will win the Senate as well.
Okay. Mark it down. Ramesh Panuru, thank you so much for being here. Always a pleasure. Sorry it's been a while. And hope to have you back on soon.
Always fun.
Okay, so Ramesh has left the building. Hopefully, since I'm talking to you from the past, hopefully not too much dramatic has changed to render all of this moot. You know, if we were all huddling by garbage can fires, eating rats by Tuesday, this podcast probably won't go out anyway. We'll have other priorities. Jack, did anything vex you about this? So you listened to the Nick Gillespie thing, right? The greatest crossover event since some other crossover event?
Yep.
Any peeves, grievances, corrections? I've been killing myself. I've been muttering to myself for 3 days now. Herculoids, because I couldn't remember the name of the Hanna-Barbera cartoon with the Herculoids in it. But other than that,
congratulations.
Yeah. So for all I know, by the time this airs, the story will have developed more. But this weird attack by, you know, my friend Tucker Carlson on Ben Sasse.
You know it's serious when they call them my friend.
That's right. As I understand it, the argument is that Ben Sasse is somehow responsible for the fact that one sporting good chain bought another sporting good chain. And that if Ben Sasse cared about the people of Nebraska, he would have prevented one private sector company from merging with another private sector company, because that's what senators do. It's weird. It's like one of my big peeves I think I talked about this on GLOP or something, but one of my big peeves about bad sort of political thriller, international intrigue movies like
Paddington.
Paddington, Chained Heat. No, like that Mark Wahlberg movie Shooter, like the Tom Clancy second season a little bit.
The Jack Ryan second season?
Jack Ryan second season. The Jason Bourne thing. There are all these, like, every now and then there's like these senators who supposedly are running their own off-book, you know, black ops operation where they can send American troops into battle to go do coups or whatever, and that, like, somehow there's, like, some paperwork that allows the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee to tell a group of Navy SEALs to go do something. It just doesn't work like that.
Now who's being nice?
It's the same thing with this idea that, like, in one senator would have, you know, would have stopped this thing from happening, or that, never mind that he should have. And this is, you know, again, I really like Tucker personally, and we go way back, but his approach, like what he did at the National Review Institute, where, you know, he says, look, the market is just a tool, like a toaster or whatever. First of all, it's not just a tool. It is a tool, but it's not just a tool. A gun is a tool, but a gun is also the manifestation of your Second Amendment right to protect yourself. A pen is just a tool, but a pen is also one way of expressing your First Amendment right. A church is just a tool in the sense that it's just a place where you go to do something. But it's also the physical manifestation of your First Amendment right to worship freely and to assemble freely and all of these various things. The market is just a tool in the sense that it is what the Marxists used to call praxis. It's the point of the meeting of theory and practice in a real way, and markets solve problems as tools, but they are also the manifestation of a fundamental right to pursue happiness as you see it, to purchase things, to use the fruits of your labor as you see fit within very broad constraints. And to relegate markets to the tool suggests that there are people who know how to use these tools better, and that Tucker's one of them. And then the problem is that whenever Tucker gets pressed on this stuff, I'm not an economist, I'm not a policy wonk, whatever. And it's a very sort of John Stewart-y kind of thing where he does these sweeping broadsides against the free market right up until someone says, well, what do you want to do instead? And he says, I don't know, that's not my thing.
It's funny because John Stewart and Tucker Carlson are such good friends.
Yeah, no, there's a certain amount of irony there. And I took very much Tucker's side in the John Stewart-Tucker stuff. I thought Tucker's, one of the things that Tucker had over his opponents on Crossfire was that, unlike James Carville and Paul Begala, Tucker actually said what he personally believed rather than sort of what the party line of the day was. And so I take Tucker at his word that he believes a lot of this stuff. But, it just strikes me as a lot of demagoguery most of the time, because the idea that there's, suggests that Ben Sasse is bought and paid for by Paul Singer, because Paul Singer is his number one donor or number one contributor or something like that, leaving out the fact that I think Paul Singer or Elliott Capital Management or whatever it's called gave $5,400, which was the legal maximum to Ben Sasse's campaign or something, which has probably Singer tied with, 1,000, 10,000, 15,000 other people and institutions that maxed out at $5,400. And the idea that Ben Sasse would have exercised his moral and constitutional principles and stopped this Bass Pro Shops from merging with Cabela's, if only he hadn't been bribed by $5,400. It's just, I can't believe that Tucker actually believes that. And so anyway, just this kind of stuff, which is so prevalent on the right these days, these sort of, sort of glib guilt by association attempts to sort of smear politicians who aren't completely in the party line, or to make these arguments that somehow we all know how better to run the economy. It's just that these corrupt forces inside of Washington and the libertarian hegemony in Washington are preventing it from happening. I just find so wildly unpersuasive. It really drives me crazy. And I guess I held it against Ramesh a little too much. Anyway, that's all I've got.
Well, Jack, that's not all I've got.
Okay.
There are two remnant-related items that we need to address here. I'll let you pick which one goes first. We have a late entry to the accent contest.
Dear God, okay.
And a chance to prove, to debate whether you're right about something.
Okay. I'll take new accents for 200, Alex.
So you may have seen on Twitter that there was demand for Madeline Cairns to submit a voice.
I have. I've wanted her on the podcast.
Well, she's been on mine. We're friends.
I understand that.
And I asked her about this, and she was game.
Okay.
So we've got it right here. And I'm going to do what we did last time, play it for you as I have it in studio, and then put the real, better recording in the actual show. Full transparency. So here we go. Make sure this is loud enough.
I'm quite sure that a man of your intelligence will see that there can be but one outcome to this affair. It is necessary that you should withdraw. You have worked things in such a fashion that we have only one resource left. It has been an intellectual treat to me to see the way in which you have grappled with this matter, but I say, unaffectedly, that it would be a grief for me to be forced to take an extreme measure. Oh, you smile, sir, but it really would be, I do assure you. This is not danger. It is inevitable destruction. You stand in the way not merely of an individual, but of a mighty organization, the full extent of which even you, with all your cleverness, have been unable to realize. You must stand clear, Mr. Holmes, or be trodden underfoot.
So there we go. What do you think?
I don't want to be sexist about this, but
that's a great way to start a sentence.
It is, isn't it? She sounds less like a supervillain to me, and more like a lady I really would not want to cross opposing the construction of a highway in Glasgow or something. she's also just too euphonious. I mean,
she is a trained singer.
I know. She's more like the voice that says in heaven, there's no parking in the white zone or something. I mean, there's a weird sort of mellifluous euphony to her voice that I just I'm hard to judge, but I compared to Hannon and Ferguson, the nefarious Moriarty thing does not come through as much.
Yeah, but remember the original.
But the original point is who has the nicest accent? I think she wins. I mean, I honestly do, but that's just, it's Maybe it's just my fondness for the feminine Scottish accent or something, but I think it's great.
And so that leaves to debating whether you're right.
Yeah, but hold on. We should tell listeners, if they have no idea what we're talking about here, that this was a longstanding thing where we're going to have a competition of various accents of foreign accented or Anglophile accented.
Who have been on the show.
Who have been on the show. And it was at the end of the Andy Smerik episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, that we ran the entries from Charlie Cook, Daniel Hannan, and Neil Ferguson.
And Sean Connery.
And Sean Connery. So if you want to go listen to that whole episode or just fast forward to the end, you can hear those entries there. Okay. What am I wrong or right about?
So the Remnant, the post-National Review Remnant has just crossed the 2 million listens, 2 million downloads marker.
Outstanding.
And we, back when it crossed 1 million, uh-huh. I think this was in September. Early September.
Uh-huh.
You asked me to predict when it would cross 2 million.
Uh-huh.
I'll insert the real audio of this here, but since and you can listen to that and make sure that I'm not lying to you, but you said the nub of it was that I said that it would happen sometime before, after Thanksgiving, before
Christmas.
Before Washington depopulates for Christmas.
Uh-huh.
And based on the status quo projection into the future, which we said is always dangerous, as Orwell writes about in Second Thoughts on James Burnham, you said that before you thought it would happen before Thanksgiving.
Jack informs me that we've passed a crucial benchmark, right? We the post-National Review remnant. Do I have this right, Jack? Passed a million downloads?
Yeah. Just when I predicted it would happen.
This has all happened before.
All is proceeding as I have foreseen.
I know this is doesn't sound all that exciting and all the rest, but it's nice news. You know, the Bulwark, I think they just passed 5 million downloads, but they have they've been around.
Don't worry about other people.
I know. This is like I've burnt my ships. I've done. You know, I've made a major commitment to doing this thing. I have to be something of a cheerleader for this thing that I've, you know, set a course for the rest of my professional life on. So I love the Bulwark. I listen to it. I think that's a great benchmark. It'd be great. When would you predict our next million download mark would, our 2 million download mark was? Mark it down, dude.
It'll happen before, well, assuming the status quo, which is always dangerous, as George Orwell once warned us, if the circumstances of this podcast remained exactly the same, then it would happen, a couple weeks before the end of the year.
Uh-huh.
Maybe like just before DC depopulates for Christmas and whatnot.
Yeah. So straight line projections into the future, as that's the oral reference you're getting at, which comes from one of my favorite essays, Second Thoughts on James Burnham, have their flaws. And I in modest confidence, think that we will hit 2 million downloads before Thanksgiving.
Okay.
So.
You have more information. There's an information asymmetry here.
There is indeed. There is indeed. And that's the way God designed it. Anyway.
Well, it happened on, as best I can tell, it happened on sometime between November 26th and November 27th.
Really?
So that would have been either the 2 days before or the day before Thanksgiving proper. So you could say that you're right, but I think this just goes to prove that George Orwell is actually right, because the margin by which at that point the episode exceeded 2 million, it would have been changed if David French had not been hired, because the episode on which he appeared had it moved outside of the range of downloads that
the normal 500 to a million, 500,000 to a million downloads we get.
Yeah, it was slightly more than that. By enough that if it had just been like a different guest,
I understand,
it would have been still less than 2 million at that point.
Uh-huh.
And I did not know that you were going to hire David French at that point. I don't know if you did either.
Uh-huh.
But so that I think Orwell is the real one who's right here. Not you.
I think both of us, let's look. look, we both knew that we were also going to have a lot of nerdy policy wonk guests on this show. And then we're going to have some people who are going to be of more interest to people on this show. So I think that we're both close enough to write. But I'm going to take credit for being actually loosely right.
Well, I guess it is your podcast.
Okay, so you still have not watched Mandalorian?
No, and I'm not going to.
You should.
Well, I'm not going to.
All right. So thanks to Rameshpreneur for coming in. Thanks to our listeners. Thanks to everybody who made the, who got us to the 2 million mark. Should we have a prediction about when we get to the 3 million mark?
No, there's too much I don't know.
Okay. So what was the delta? What's the right word? What's the space between the 1 million and 2 million? It was like...
I believe it was like early, so maybe September 4th, 5th to November 26th to 27th.
Okay.
So just under 3 months.
Yeah.
Or like...
2.5 months.
10 weeks, 9 weeks.
Yeah. Okay. So... I'm not sure whether we're going to have some hiatus over the Christmas thing, so that could affect my numbers. I have to do this math very carefully. I need my slide rule and my abacus. But
your goat entrails.
Goat entrails, Eye of Newt. I am going to say we're going to hit 3 million by the 1st of March. There you go.
Okay.
And hey, look, advertisers should take note about the growing, just surging popularity of this podcast. And if you want to advertise, you should contact us. You can drop us an email at theremnantpod@gmail.com. We should come up with a dispatch email. What's the best email to do this? What is our email address?
You just said it. Keep
TheRemnantPod@gmail.com?
Uh-huh.
Okay. And we'll change that soon. But for now, that should work. And thanks again to everybody for listening. Thank you for signing up to everybody who was willing to start with the yearly subscriptions now rather than waiting for the paywall to go up. We are super grateful for that. That's a huge deal for us. It gives us more maneuvering room. So if you're inclined to do that, please go to thedispatch.com and subscribe. But you can still sign up for free for all our wares. And I'll see you next time.
I find this highly illogical.
From far beyond the galaxies, I've journeyed to this place to study the behavior patterns of the human race. And I find them highly illogical. Girl meets boy. They fall in love. She says he's everything she's dreamed of. But when they get married, before he's aware, she changes his habits, the way he combs his hair. She changes him to someone he's never been, and then complains he's not like other men. Now really, I find this most illogical.
Yeah, that's probably it.
Okay, recording?
Yep.